Yeah, it's 9:05, so I guess what the heck, let's start. So, you guys have all gotten up early to check out managed storage in CloudStack. That was kind of a term that we came up with about 4 years ago. Have you guys kind of heard that on the mailing list? Are you guys all sort of familiar with the term managed? We'll get into that as we go, but it's just kind of, when you hear managed storage, it's to be contrasted against like traditional CloudStack storage approaches where maybe you make an NFS share and then you you do this all kind of manually up front. You're the one who goes off and either if it's an iSCSI system, you go off and create the volume. Then you maybe, if it's KVM, maybe you go ahead and put a clustered file system on that. And then you finally, after you do all that kind of stuff yourself, come to CloudStack and introduce that as primary storage. So that's sort of the traditional approach. Same kind of thing with NFS. And managed storage is a little bit different, and that's kind of where we'll get into for this presentation. So if you hear managed storage, it's kind of contrasted with the whole traditional stuff that you're probably familiar with. So I don't have to spend a lot of time here, but I'm Mike Tutkowski, and I've been working at SolidFire for about 4.5 years. Pretty much the whole time on CloudStack, hey Syed. So pretty much the whole time on, got a spot right up front here for you, Syed. pretty much the whole time I've been working on CloudStack, most as you'd expect in the storage area. Playing around as well, of course, in the hypervisor areas because VMware and Zen Server, KVM, they all have different things that I need to make changes to make sure that they can leverage this kind of, I still kind of call it new storage, but it's been in CloudStack now for 3 or 4 years, and we've just been kind of adding feature after feature during that time. But that's where I spend the majority of my time, is either on the storage side or changing the hypervisor consumption of storage to make sure that it can use this kind of storage appropriately, just based on the hypervisor type that we're talking about. And then we don't really need to go a whole lot into the SolidFire side here, but from my point of view, a lot of this has been around trying to bring quality of service into CloudStack. So in the traditional storage approach, you didn't really have a whole lot of really good quality of service options. If you had an NFS share and you have a whole bunch of virtual disks on that share, even if you were able to guarantee performance to the share, you're not able to really guarantee any level of performance to each of the individual virtual disks within the share. So there really is a kind of a quality of service gap there in CloudStack, and that's just the way it was built from the beginning. It was kind of before this whole quality of service push on the storage side. So it was never really designed with that in mind. And so one of the big reasons for managed storage is if you have a system like SolidFire that can do some level of quality of service on a per volume basis, ideally you'd be able to map that back-end volume to an individual virtual disk. So whatever performance you have on the back-end volume is then passed on directly to just that virtual disk. So instead of having, in the traditional approach, a single large iSCSI volume with some kind of a clustered file system on it, and then a whole bunch of virtual disks within it, ideally you'd have a one-to-one mapping between your back-end volume and a virtual disk that makes use of that back-end volume. And some of the challenges that Syed and I have seen are around the hypervisors like Zen Server, and then I've also noticed this with VMware. So for example, Zen Server, we've maybe made it up to like 600, 700 storage repositories in a particular cluster.
No, it's about 1,000. More than 1,000?
1,000? Okay. So that's good progress, but what that means is, I guess to get more specific there, if you could make tens of thousands of volumes on the SolidFire cluster, the problem is, each of those, if you're using Zen Server, you have to have a Zen server storage repository on those, and then just have a single virtual disk within that. And what Syed and I noticed is that you can maybe get up into, I guess, the thousands range before Zen server gets incredibly slow. If you reboot the hosts, it can be very slow to boot up, and I think it just kind of comes to a crawl at some point on the hypervisor side. So Zen server has an issue like that. VMware has a similar issue where maybe they support about 512 data stores per cluster. So there are different approaches that we've taken to try to help with the scalability of these hypervisors. But one thing that I've noticed too is with KVM, for example, it's a kind of a different approach than Zen Server and VMware. There, if I make a back-end volume on the KVM side, we can pass that directly into the VM. Doesn't have to have any kind of clustered file system on it. It's just passed in as a raw volume. And the scalability limits that we see within VMware and Zen Server basically just don't apply for KVM. So there's different kind of caveats for managed storage depending on the hypervisor type that you use. KVM, not really any kind of scalability issue. Zen Server and VMware, there are some limitations there. So there's probably situations where on Zen Server and VMware, where you'd actually have certain applications that you want to make sure, maybe these are your mission critical applications. There are certain cases where maybe you'd want to use managed storage for those. Guarantee for that virtual disk, it has its own back-end volume with its own guaranteed quality of service. And then maybe your lesser critical applications, they could use the traditional approach where their virtual disks reside with other virtual disks in a clustered file system that's backed by some, either an NFS share or an iSCSI volume. We'll get into kind of more of this as we go, and of course just ask questions as we go. Don't have to save anything up for the end. So that's just kind of where I come in, is just kind of coming in from a quality of service standpoint and trying to bring this to CloudStack. Just a quick high-level overview of how storage looks in CloudStack. This is as of the 4.2 release, which is about 3.5 years old now. The main difference here is that primary storage was actually added as an option at the zone level. So with our traditional primary storage in CloudStack, it was always available just as either local or shared storage within a single compute cluster. So if you had a couple Zen server clusters, your storage in the one cluster could not be seen by the hosts in the other cluster. This kind of allowed you to have the option of bringing out primary storage to the zone level, and there's a couple different ways that can be used. We'll see one of the ways, the way that my particular plugin uses it in just a bit, but probably a lot of you are familiar with just this general zone pod cluster concept in CloudStack. Just to make sure everybody's on the same page, zone is typically associated with a data store, pod is kind of a rack within your data center. Did I say data store? I meant zone is a data center. Pod is a rack within your data center. And then cluster would be your compute cluster. So your Zen server, your KVM, Hyper-V, all of your different compute cluster options there. And then obviously in the upper right, we just see secondary storage. I'm not going to focus much on secondary storage for the purposes of this presentation. That's for all of our VM templates and our backups, what CloudStack calls volume snapshots, but they're really kind of backups that reside on a different storage system. Those are all kind of stored on our secondary storage options, which are usually just NFS, and maybe you might, I know you guys at CloudOps, you guys probably use Swift, right, as well, which still requires NFS as kind of like a intermediary, if I remember. So there we are, kind of for an overview of CloudStack and some of its storage options. Now, I kind of described this a little while ago, but let's just kind of go through for the purpose of completeness and just talk about what traditional storage looked like in CloudStack. And to be clear, you can, of course, do all of this stuff today. And in fact, as I mentioned, due to some scalability limitations within VMware and Zen Server, there is definitely cause on those hypervisors to use both a hybrid approach, some managed storage, and then some of the traditional storage, depending on the criticality of the workload that you're running. So traditionally, what you would see is it's kind of a manual process up front. As an administrator, you'd either go and, if you have a NAS device, you'd go create a share on that NAS device. If it's an iSCSI system, you'd create a volume on that. And you do that through whatever interfaces you have for your storage system. Maybe for the SolidFire system, you'd go in through the GUI, or if you have some scripts that you've written that consume the API, you could go and run those. But either way, it's kind of the same thing. You're going off to your storage system, which is completely, at this point, outside of CloudStack's knowledge, and you're creating a share or a volume. And then that second point is, you're then going over to the hypervisor that you're using, and it just depends. If it's Zen Server, you're going to create a storage repository, and that storage repository could either consume your NFS share, or if it was an iSCSI volume, it's going to be basically the process of putting CLVM, Clustered Logical Volume Manager, on basically a clustered file system on your iSCSI volume. So you kind of have that process first from the storage system's point of view, then you come over to the hypervisor, same kind of thing with VMware, either maybe do some kind of an NFS data store or a VMFS data store. KVM, it's kind of common, take your iSCSI backend volume and install something like OCFS2 on it, which is just a clustered file system again. At a high level, the point is you've got a couple different targets here. You've got to first go off to your storage system, create the storage, then go to your hypervisor, put some kind of a file system on it, and now you're finally able to come to CloudStack. So this is all kind of a manual process. And typically you're allocating big chunks of data on your storage system. Maybe you're making an 8 terabyte iSCSI based volume, something large, because you expect to place a lot of virtual disks on that. So you've got these two separate steps, then you finally come to CloudStack, you add your primary storage that's based on whatever hypervisor type you're using, and now you've got access to some kind of storage within CloudStack. The final bullet point there, number four, is at this point you're able to make your compute and your disk offering. So your compute offering, the only thing that really is relevant for the compute offering is the storage tags area, so it just lets you know which primary storages are candidates for housing the root disk of any VMs that you spin up using that compute offering. And then similarly for the disk offerings, you specify things like the size of the volume and the storage tags, again pointing to whatever primary storage can support that particular disk offering's storage tag. So this is stuff that if you've used CloudStack for a while and you have some level of interaction with primary storage, you've probably gone through a process like this. So just for the sake of clarity, they would just call that traditional storage these days, and it's completely as valid as it ever was in the past. So managed storage doesn't replace this. It's just sort of like an extra option if you have more need for predictable performance and things like that. So what we just discussed a moment ago with traditional primary storage, that would actually be on that left-hand side in the image. What you're seeing there is you have a typically a large NFS share or a large iSCSI volume, and then you put your file system on that, and then you store a whole bunch of virtual disks within that. The trick here is, even if you have a back-end system like SolidFire that can guarantee performance to the iSCSI volume, if you're running multiple virtual disks on that volume and you don't have any way to control performance on a virtual disk by virtual disk basis, which is really just understood by the hypervisor, then you don't have any way to guarantee how much performance you give to one virtual disk versus another. If you have a lot of virtual disks on that same file system, which is backed by just a single guaranteed performance volume, you never know if one of the applications using one of those disks is going to go crazy with activity and start sucking all of the performance away from the other virtual disks. It'll eventually hit the performance limits that the backend volume specifies for it, but in the meanwhile, you could have the other applications using those other virtual disks suffer a lot of performance degradation. So the idea there is, maybe for some of your lower performing applications, that might be okay. Maybe it's just an intermittent performance hit, and if it's not a really critical application, that's acceptable. If you have more mission critical applications that you want to make sure that you actually have a set amount of performance and that is not going to be impacted by any of the other activity, any of the other applications using storage from your backend system, then that's where we get into kind of the managed storage area. And that's the right-hand side. And very simply, that's just saying for a backend volume that has a guaranteed level of performance, we want to make sure that the virtual disks, there's really just one virtual disk on that. So there's a one-to-one mapping really between a backend volume and a virtual disk. And in fact, depending on the hypervisor type, like we were talking about a moment ago, if it's KVM, you can actually do this for all of your virtual disks. It doesn't really even matter if you have higher criticality applications mixed with lower criticality applications. They can all use this approach because KVM is very scalable in terms of being able to make use of just thousands of back-end volumes within the same KVM cluster. If you have other hypervisor types like Zen Server, VMware, since they do have some issues with number of data stores and storage repositories, that's where you kind of get into this hybrid approach where maybe you just put your mission critical applications on managed storage, and the other maybe mid-range or lower performing applications, they can use the traditional approach where you're not as concerned if they see sort of intermittent performance issues. So that's kind of the high-level difference between those two kinds of storage. And again, let me know if you have any questions going along the way here. I'm going to walk through now kind of an example of how you actually set up managed storage and then make use of it within CloudStack. A lot of it is going to be similar and very familiar just based on your probably experience with traditional storage. And then there'll be some differences along the way as well. So for a lot of people, they're probably familiar with the add primary storage dialog. There's a couple differences here when we go to adding primary storage that's going to make use of managed storage. The one thing at the very top is that in my case, I support it at the cluster scope or the zone scope. So typically, a lot of my customers, they just take a SolidFire cluster, they'll assign a certain percentage of its capacity and performance, give it to CloudStack, and they'll put it at the zone level and then allow that to be utilized from multiple clusters simultaneously within CloudStack. And I'll explain how that's possible in just a moment. So what we do see on the top, this particular one that I'm adding is at the zone level. The hypervisor, unlike what you're used to with traditional storage, since this is at the zone level and you actually can have multiple hypervisor types within a zone, we pick any here. It may be a little bit vague at this point. Really, for most managed storage right now, it's typically Zen Server, KVM, and VMware that are actually supported, not so much Hyper-V or OVM3. But just kind of FYI, just pick any and just don't use it with those other hypervisor types. I've actually never seen nobody's ever asked me for support for this for Hyper-V or OVM. Just those other kind of three popular hypervisor types in CloudStack. So you pick your zone like you're used to, give it a name. the protocol, you might see things normally you're familiar with, maybe VMFS, NFS. Here, you just pick the custom option. And when you do that, you'll see a couple extra fields kind of be displayed in the dialog. The one is the provider field, which is right below that. The provider field is really just a list of plugins, storage plugins, that CloudStack is aware of. They didn't have to be there by default. You could have installed them after the fact. There are several plugins that just kind of come default with CloudStack. Depending on if the vendor, like what we do is we just make our plugin available in the CloudStack Git repository. So whenever a release is built, like this 4.10 release that we're building, this particular plugin is just automatically distributed with that CloudStack release. Some vendors prefer to keep their code within their own code base, and then they'll just provide a jar file later, which the customer can install, and then they restart the management servers. And either way, if you don't see the your particular storage plugin here in the provider field, then CloudStack doesn't know about it. So that would kind of be a first kind of troubleshooting thing. If you don't see it here, CloudStack doesn't know about it. So all I've done here is I've just selected the SolidFire storage plugin. The manage checkbox is kind of depends on how the plugin is implemented. In my case, this plugin just supports managed storage. So you don't actually have to check that checkbox. It'll be managed regardless. If you wanted to, you could develop a plugin that does managed and unmanaged. And at that point, I suppose that checkbox would let you know which way to treat this particular primary storage. I just checked the box here just to make it clear that this is managed storage. Now, the other fields right below that are kind of where this differs from traditional primary storage. With traditional primary storage, when you add primary storage here, you're actually going to point to something like a storage repository on Zen Server or a data store on VMware. That already existed because as we talked about before, I went off and I created a volume using, you know, something completely outside of CloudStack. Then I put the storage repository on it. Now within CloudStack, I would just be pointing to that storage repository. Here, it's going to be different because we didn't have to do any of that stuff. All CloudStack wants to know for this kind of managed storage is how many bytes or how much capacity, basically, and how much performance, if your system supports performance limitations, can be used from the back-end system when it creates new virtual disks. So it's kind of this humongous number in my case. I'm just telling the system, you can use for my SolidFire cluster 2 petabytes and 4.5 million IOPS. It's kind of weird that they don't use gigabytes in the GUI. It's just bytes. So you end up with this humongous number. So what this is saying is, as I spin up virtual machines, they have their root disks. Maybe I add additional data disks. For every single virtual disk that is going to use this storage, let's say we don't have any right now. We want to make our first one. Maybe it's a 20 gigabyte root disk. What CloudStack will look at is how many bytes from that particular primary storage have already been consumed. In this case, we still have 2 petabytes left. So if we wanted a 20 gigabyte root disk, no problem. We have plenty of capacity left, so it passes that check. Maybe our root disk also wanted something like 500 minimum IOPS, so some kind of a performance guarantee. If you said you needed 500, it'll look and say, okay, we've got 4.5 million IOPS. Let's look and see how many of those are already in use for other virtual disks. In this case, I didn't have any to begin with, so this will be the first one. It'll say, okay, 500 minimum IOPS. I can support that as well. So you've passed your capacity restriction there, your quota, and your performance quota. So it says, okay, that's fine. We can then go ahead and create a new volume on the back-end system that has the right size that you specified, the right performance, and we'll use that for that virtual disk. So this is really just telling CloudStack, I've got a back-end storage area network. It's got this much capacity and this much performance that I'm allowing you within CloudStack to use. This could actually be Maybe my SAN actually has 4 petabytes worth of storage, and I'm giving half of it to CloudStack. Maybe I'm using the other half for some other unrelated CloudStack activity. It's up to you here to decide how much you want to give to CloudStack. You can change it later. So if you decide you've used up close to that 2 petabyte range and you want to bump it up later, you just have to go into the edit storage options that you're familiar with in changing primary storage. Just bump the number up. You can even bump it down, and we'll just make sure we check to make sure that you're not bumping it down below something that's already in use. And if you're not, then you can bump it down as well. So this is just sort of a starting point, just letting CloudStack know you have this amount of performance, this amount of capacity. Go make a bunch of virtual disks until you hit one of these limits or both. The URL field, which we won't get into a whole lot here, if you're using something like traditional primary storage, that's going to be completely different from what this is. This here for URL is really just a collection of key value pairs that are going to be vendor specific. So in my case, I have floating IP addresses for the management path and a floating IP address for the data path. The management path would be used for things like I need to create a volume, I need to create a SolidFire account, or I need to create an access control list, all of those kind of management activities. And that typically takes place over like a 1 gig network. The data path is something that's usually going to be done over a 10 gig network, and those are going to be your iSCSI related commands. And that has its own floating IP address. So the hypervisor, when it goes to log into an iSCSI volume, would look at that storage virtual IP address, which is one of the parameters that you pass here, and it would just, one of the nodes in the scale-out cluster supports, is hosting one of those IP addresses, and that's the one that you go to say, I'd like to log into this particular volume, and once that's successful, it'll just make sure that you're load balanced appropriately across the cluster, so you have a pretty even distribution of iSCSI connections just to kind of balance out the traffic across the cluster. But we don't probably need to get into those too much, but that's just a bunch of key value pairs. What's the administrator name that I want to use when I send commands like create volume? What's his password? Things like that. But that's just basically going to be a bunch of vendor-specific information. A lot of it is probably going to be fairly common. Everybody's going to need to send their commands to some IP address. They're going to need to have some username and some password. That's where you provide that information. And the bottom one is just a storage tag like what you'd be familiar with any kind of primary storage. We're going to use that in a moment when we kind of see in the slide deck here how to create a compute offering that makes use of this primary storage. But it's very similar to any kind of primary storage in CloudStack. There's no like special use for storage tagging here. So once we hit the OK button, there's actually not much to do in this case. In a lot of other traditional types of primary storage, you'd actually go out to Zen Server, that cluster, and see if you can confirm the existence of that storage repository, see how large it is, that kind of stuff. It takes a little time. Here, we actually just really provided you with information about the SAN and how much performance, how much capacity you can use. So when you hit OK, it's really just a matter of adding that information to the storage pool table in the cloud database. So it's done very quickly. What you'll see then is if we go to your list of primary storages, the one that I've highlighted there or circled is our new primary storage. It looks just like any other primary storage. In this particular case, it was zone wide, so you won't see anything listed in the cluster column. But if you did make it for cluster scope, then it would kind of look more similar to the other ones as well. It's not going to be anything unique from this kind of a point of view. It's just going to look like any primary storage. You create a bunch of virtual disks that make use of it, just like any other primary storage. And in the table here, you're just going to always see just that one primary storage that's responsible for all of those virtual disks. So nothing special or unique in this sense. All right. Now let's go, now we've got our primary story. Yeah?
Short question. In the global settings, you can set the storage thresholds. Are they related to the whole system, as you added to say here, or to single volumes?
They would be related to the storage pool itself. So if you said you really only wanted to use like 80% of the possible capacity, and I don't think there's any hook-ins for the performance options there to say that you want to use 80% or whatever, but if you said you wanted to use 80% of the possible amount of storage for a particular primary storage, it'll work the same way here. So if you gave it 2 petabytes, it'll stop allowing you to create things when you hit around 80, whatever you specified for that limit. Mm-hmm. Yep. Cool, so now we've got our primary storage. It's just there like any other primary storage. We're gonna go ahead and create a disk offering here. So just as you're familiar with, go down to the service offerings tab in the bottom left. It looks like I'm making a disk offering here. So we'll go down to the same thing, service offerings tab. The default view is for the compute offerings. In this case, we're gonna switch that select offering kind of in the middle to disk offerings. And then in the upper right, we'll go ahead and click the button to create a new disk offering. And then I've circled here in the add disk offering dialog that gets popped up some of the important differences that you now have available if you're using this kind of primary storage that has performance guarantees. So everything else, the top portion, the name, the description, it's going to be considered shared primary storage. All of that kind of stuff is just sort of business as usual. You can provide a size, of course, to the virtual disks that are created when you select this disk offering, just like any other kind of a disk that's created from primary storage. The interesting part here is what's circled, and this is all around storage quality of service. So what you have is this QoS type row in the dialog, and by default it's actually blank, which would just kind of be backward compatible with CloudStack since the beginning of CloudStack time, just saying that there is no quality of service. If you drop it down, there's two options. There's the hypervisor QoS, which is rate limiting for KVM. That is a thing that's separate from storage QoS. What we're focusing on here is the backend QoS system. So if you select the storage option, that's referring to quality of service that may be provided by your backend storage system. When you select that, you'll see a couple fields pop up below it. And those are part of that circled area. There's the custom IOPS checkbox, which by default is not checked. There's a min IOPS and a max IOPS field. And then there's something called hypervisor snapshot reserve, which we can get into in a second. The custom IOPS, by default, it's not checked. And what that's saying is you as an administrator who are creating this disk offering, it's saying that you want to specify the min and the max IOPS yourself. So when one of your users selects this disk offering, they will get this kind of performance out of that virtual disk. And that's probably the most common scenario, especially in public clouds. People have a variety of compute and disk offerings with different size and performance characteristics, and then their end users basically just look at a catalog of options and pick what they want based on what they're willing to pay for and how much capacity and performance they actually need. Now, in some private clouds, some of our customers use this custom IOPS checkbox. If they check that, what's happening there is it's very similar to the custom size checkbox. I think we actually have that up top. Yeah, custom disk size. If you were to check that, it's the same idea. As an administrator, you don't provide the size of the virtual disk. Same idea here. As an administrator, you don't provide the performance of the virtual disk. That's passed on to the end user when he or she selects this compute offering or the disk offering. They're given that option to fill in the size and or the performance. So sometimes that's an option that is used in private clouds where I guess the IT people feel that they have more control over their end users. In a public cloud, a lot of times people use that left option and just provide a variety of compute and disk offerings with different sizes and performance characteristics. Now, the hypervisor snapshot reserve is something that depends on the hypervisor type that's going to consume that virtual disk. If it's KVM, you don't have to worry about this hypervisor snapshot reserve field at all. If it's VMware or Zen server, you can leave it blank and will provide a default value. But the gist here is that because Zen server and VMware don't take that volume on the back end and directly pass it in to the VM that makes use of it, they take that disk on the back end and they'll put some kind of a clustered file system on it, like VMFS if it's VMware, or CLVM if it's Zen server. So they have another layer that's being placed on it before they put the virtual disk within it. And so there's going to be some extra space that needs to be taken up for that. So if you say you want a 20 gigabyte virtual disk, I can't just make a 20 gigabyte volume on the SolidFire system, because some of that space is going to be consumed by the clustered file system that is kind of like overhead that gets placed on that before your virtual disk. So there's that overhead. Plus, on Zen server and VMware, you can take hypervisor snapshots within CloudStack. So basically snapshots that the backend system isn't aware of. They're just other Delta disks within your clustered file system that you can revert back to if you want to at some point in time. But that takes up space within the clustered file system. So if you want to take hypervisor-based snapshots, you need to make sure you have some way of controlling how big that backend volume is. So maybe you have a virtual disk, it's going to be 20 gigabytes, and maybe you want to make the backend volume twice as large because you want to have some hypervisor snapshots share that same clustered file system within that backend volume. So this is your way of controlling it. If you said the hypervisor snapshot reserve is 100, that just means 100% of the size of the virtual disk. So if you want a 20 gigabyte root disk and you want your backend volume to be twice as large, 100% means I need my backend volume to be 20 gigabytes for the original volume, plus an additional 100% of that 20 gigabytes for potential hypervisor snapshots. So it would just be 20 plus 20, and the backend volume would end up being 40 gigabytes. You'd have your clustered file system on that, and to start with, you'd just have either a VMDK file for VMware or a VHD file for Zen server that's 20 gigabytes. And then if you want to take hypervisor snapshots, those can fit within that clustered file system because you made the backend volume large enough. So, and for KVM, it doesn't really apply, because what we're doing for KVM is we're making that backend volume, and then you're just passing it in as a raw virtual disk to the virtual machine, and it will go ahead and just take that like any other virtual device it has, any persistent storage device, and it can put a file system of its own on that. It can do whatever it wants with it, but there's not this layer of a clustered file system in between and the possibility of hypervisor snapshots and things like that. So that's what that means for hypervisor snapshot reserve. Worst case, if you don't use hypervisor snapshots, you can just leave it blank. Don't do anything with it. And actually, there's good reason why you might not even want to bother with hypervisor snapshots, because we do support with managed storage. Depending on how your plugin is implemented, taking volume snapshots that reside on the storage system itself. So unlike traditional volume snapshots in CloudStack, which is kind of a two-phased approach, for VMware, you might say take a volume snapshot. What happens is they take a hypervisor snapshot, which leads to another VMDK file being placed in the data store, and then you have basically a read-only VMDK file, which gets copied in the background to secondary storage. And once that process is done, oh, hi, you guys come in. No problem. But it's a time-consuming process. What we call volume snapshots is really backups. With managed storage, you have the option of actually saying, I want a volume snapshot, and then within a moment, the hypervisor, I mean the storage system, can take a backend snapshot and treat it just like any other volume snapshot in CloudStack, except for it happened, you know, really fast and there was no data copy from one storage system to another. It really is a snapshot in that case instead of a backup. So let's see here, what time do we got just to make sure I get everything in here? Oh yeah, I got about 10 minutes. So, all right, we've got our disk offering now. We want to go ahead and actually make use of it. So as an end user, we just log in as a regular user, and we go over to the storage tab, which is highlighted in the bottom left. And then in the upper right, we just click add. We want to create a new volume. And after we've done that, we come to this normal dialog that you're used to, the add volume dialog. Couple different variants of it, depending on how the administrator set up that disk offering. On the left-hand side, it's assuming the administrator specified the size and the performance of the volumes that will be created when you use that particular disk offering. So there's nothing for an end user to do here except for select the disk offering. I didn't specify the size, but in this case, it's telling the end user you're going to get a volume with 1,000 min IOPS and 2,000 max IOPS. Now, it depends on your backend system how those IOPS are interpreted. On the SolidFire system, those are going to be 4K IOPS. Other systems, they may have other ways of treating it. So there's one example there that for an end user, you might not go so fine-grained and say 1,000 IOPS and that kind of thing. You might just say it's kind of like low, medium, high, or something like that. It might be more vague. It depends on your end users. If your end users know what kind of an IOPS we're talking about here, how large that is, then maybe you get very detailed and say, hey, this one's got 1,000 min IOPS. And they can just pick from a catalog, do they want 1,000, do they want 1,500, 2,000? So it's kind of up to you to decide how fine-grained to make your descriptions. The right-hand dialog is what the user will see if the administrator created a disk offering that did not specify the performance. And so then it's up to the end user to decide how much performance to request for this particular volume. I mean, you could put in, you know, some potentially crazy numbers there, so that's why the option may not be typically very popular in a public cloud, but in a private cloud where people tend to know their end users a little bit more, this option might be more prevalent. So here you've gone ahead, you've selected your disk offering, potentially filled in the performance, you hit the OK button, and at this point nothing really happens other than the data is added to the volumes table in the cloud database. Nothing has really happened with the, we haven't even picked a primary storage yet. There's nothing going on with the plugins. It's not until you first attach that data disk to a VM for the first time that CloudStack will go through. It'll look at the disk offering that you selected. It'll find the storage tags area. It'll try to match up storage tags with potential primary storages. In our example here, I only had one primary storage that was using this particular storage tag, so it would be a pretty clear-cut decision for CloudStack. It would find our managed primary storage. It knows the provider or the plugin that you associated with that primary storage, so therefore it knows which storage object within CloudStack to start invoking functionality on. So when CloudStack needs to request that a volume be created, in this case, it'll see that the provider is the SolidFire plugin. It'll go ahead and grab that plugin, tell that plugin, go and create a volume with this size, this performance. The plugin will then go ahead and talk to the backend system using the data that we provided in that URL field when we created the primary storage in the first place. So it knows which endpoint to talk to. It knows I'm creating a volume with this size, this performance. Once that's all done, it can add the data to the CloudStack database, and CloudStack knows that this particular volume that was just created, now if it's depending on the hypervisor type, CloudStack can take it from there. So that's where the managed part comes in. CloudStack knows this is managed storage. You went off and dynamically created a new object on your storage system. Now what do I as CloudStack have to do about that? If it's KVM, it's not much more than sending a command to have that particular iSCSI volume just be passed into the VM as a new device. There's no clustered file system placed on it or anything. If it's Zen server, CloudStack knows, all right, I have to send a command to the Zen server resource to take this volume, put a clustered file system on it, create a new VHD file, and then that VHD file can be attached to the appropriate VM. So that's kind of where the word managed comes from, is that CloudStack can do all of this stuff around potentially creating storage repository or a data store. Depending on the hypervisor type, CloudStack just takes care of it for you. It's kind of managed by CloudStack. So here you've done that. You've attached your volume to your VM. Let's see what happens on the backend system. Part of the process is, as I just mentioned a moment ago, it's going to go off to your backend system, create a new volume. It'll have the right size, the right performance characteristics. In the case of the SolidFire system, I actually map a SolidFire account to a particular CloudStack account. So just like CloudStack is multi-tenant in nature, of course, SolidFire is as well. It's got this concept of volumes being part of accounts, just like CloudStack does. So for every CloudStack account that interacts with a SolidFire account using the plugin, there will be a corresponding SolidFire account. So if you wanted to run API commands on the SolidFire system behind the scenes and say, how much performance and capacity is this particular SolidFire account using, you can do that kind of stuff and then know that that belongs to this particular CloudStack account and get a lot of fine-grained information that may not be directly available in CloudStack at the moment. Maybe at some point in the future I might create plugins to actually GUI plugins or something like that to make that more integrated into CloudStack. But at least for the time being, you have access to kind of this big wealth of information just by virtue of having your CloudStack account mapped to a SolidFire account. So this is what happens on the backend system. What happens on the hypervisor? So there's, depending again on the hypervisor type, there's a few different things that you might see. If it's Zen server, what we'll see on the left-hand side is that you have a new storage repository show up. If you're looking at kind of your Zen server world through Zen Center, you'll see a new storage repository. If you looked within that storage repository, at first you would see just a single virtual disk, just the one VHD file. And then if you looked, of course, within your virtual machine in the far on the right side is going to have a new device that's on the bottom. It's a 100 gigabyte device here. And since that device is on its own storage repository, which is backed by its own SolidFire volume that has its own performance guarantees, that virtual disk has its own performance guarantees. It doesn't matter what other virtual disk's activity is on the storage system, this one is going to get the performance that we specified. So you have your kind of your own performance bubble on the system. So this is Zen server. Let's take a look at it from VMware's point of view. It's very similar for VMware. You have kind of, as I point out in the upper left, you have a new data store. So similarly to Zen server, having a new storage repository, on VMware, you have a new data store. And then kind of in the upper right, I actually even showed here, if you browse the contents of that data store, you'll see that at first, it just has a single VMDK file. If you were to do things like hypervisor snapshots, that's when you'd see multiple VMDK files show up within the same data store. But those VMDK files all really comprise the same virtual disk. So that same virtual disk is in its own data store, which is backed, again, by the same SolidFire volume, which has its own performance guarantees. Since it's a one-to-one mapping between the virtual disk and the backend volume, your virtual disk has its own performance guarantees, and its performance can't be impacted by any other activity on the system. So again, in the bottom right, this is just looking at it from the virtual machine's point of view. I just did an fdisk-l. You can see the bottom disk that I'm pointing to. It's just a 100 gigabyte virtual disk. You can know now, running from this virtual machine, that if you access reads, writes to this particular virtual disk, that you will have a set amount of performance. You have a minimum guarantee, you can go up to a maximum amount of performance, and then there's even this flexibility around burst performance where if you don't use your maximum all the time, if you're running below maximum, you're actually accruing credits behind the scenes on the SolidFire system. So if you do need to, like a lot of database transactions or something, if you do need to burst above your maximum for just a short amount of time, if the backend system has the available performance and you've accrued the right amount of credits, it'll just automatically let you do that until you expend your credits, or if the system really is running at maximum performance until it can no longer support that. But you know at least you have a minimum guaranteed number. If you go up to your maximum, that's great. If you go beyond it for a little bit, that's great. But you have at least that minimum. So this is from VMware's point of view. KVM's actually, as we mentioned, it's an even easier viewpoint. You create that backend volume. It's passed directly into the KVM host, which passes it directly into the VM. So there's no intermediary of a clustered file system placed on that. It's just a raw device passed into your virtual machine. Same thing, we can see in the far right bottom, 100 gigabyte virtual disk. That virtual disk really is just directly mapped to that SolidFire volume. So whatever performance the SolidFire volume has, that virtual disk has, don't have to worry about anybody else impacting your performance. And with KVM, because KVM is so scalable, you can do this for all of your virtual disks. You don't have to worry about if it's a high-performing application and you really want to make sure it has the right amount of performance all the time. You can have different compute and disk offerings that sell different performance characteristics. Maybe you just need a little performance, maybe a lot of performance. And that way, if people want to pay less for less performance, you can make sure that they get just that amount of performance they paid for. And if they later want to change that, if they want to bump their compute offering or their disk offering up to maybe have more performance, well, maybe that's, if it's a public cloud, that might be an extra charge. But there's no like bringing the volume or the VM offline to do that. You can just change performance characteristics behind the scenes, and that will just take effect immediately. There's no basically doing this in an offline fashion. Everything's done online. So that's KVM. And I think I probably got about 5 minutes, not even probably, so let me just make my way through the last couple slides. So what we can see here, as I've circled, I just gave an example. Let's pretend like I took that same disk offering, I created three volumes from it, and I attached a virtual volume to each of my three VMs, which were running in three different compute clusters. So I might have the same backend primary storage with the same disk offering and make volumes from it and attach them to different VMs in different hypervisor clusters that are different, like VMware, Zen Server, KVM. You don't have to confine your primary storage to a particular hypervisor type. So this is just showing you that the same primary storage is actually servicing, in this case, three different volumes that are each being used from different hypervisor type clusters. Does that make sense to everybody? All right, and then just to finish it up here, just to kind of note, as we talked about before, I don't have to go into it in much depth here. If you do want to use hypervisor snapshots in addition to or instead of backend snapshots, that's supported with managed storage as well on VMware and Zen Server. The last part here is just noting that volume snapshots, and I kind of mentioned this before, the way managed storage works with them is different from traditional storage. It's not a backup to secondary storage of the data. It's actually a back-end snapshot, which is typically pretty much regardless of whatever storage system you use these days, that's going to be a very fast operation. Now that really is a snapshot, it's not a backup, so you have to take that kind of stuff into consideration as well. So I think that's it. Does anybody have any questions? Or if we don't have time here, I know we're kind of getting next to the next presentation, you can always grab me after, but anything, any quick ones? Okay, cool guys, thanks a lot.